When I was walking down the hallway, I was remembering the many years that I don't sit on retreat. I do probably more self-retreat now, just because of the requirements and responsibilities in my life. But anyway, I was walking down the hall and I was remembering, you know, being on retreats, and then it would be the Dharma talk and just the excitement, you know, like the anticipation, like, you know, going to hear the Dharma talk. And then the next thought that came in my mind was from a beloved, wise theater teacher that I had, and she said, "Nobody likes to be someone's Saturday night entertainment." So the good news is that it's not entertainment. Not that there's anything wrong with entertainment, but, you know, that's not where I'm coming from. I'm not here to entertain you, although I do hope that what emerges from this system is nourishing to you, and really, at the deepest level, really supports your Dhamma practice. It really supports you and your practice and inspires you to continue. That's the most important thing. That's, you know, there's a kind of a way to listen to a Dharma talk, which is really just to notice what lands for you, you know, what feels true for you, what, you know, what wave are you surfing on, you know, as you listen, or what invitation do you have from it in something that might feel challenging to you, or no, you know, I'm just not there yet, or I don't even know what she's talking about here. And I do remember, just as an earnest practitioner, whenever I would hear a talk on no self, you know, early on, I tried so hard to like get it, and I just felt like I was literally like, you know, the invisible wall, like ding. I just couldn't get it. It just brought up a ton of anxiety. In a way, it is, actually. It could be a talk about learning walking meditation from the geese. Have you noticed that? They're just like, woo, woo, woo. It's really inspiring. So what I'd like to talk about tonight, some of you have a little preview of this. Well, no, I guess I mentioned it in the hall today earlier. Yeah, I want to talk tonight about equanimity, about the practice of equanimity, both the flowering of equanimity from practice and also the ways we can enhance it, if you will, or develop it, cultivate it. So I'd like to start here with a line from a poem that I imagine many of you are familiar with. It's from a Japanese monk, ascetic, hermit. His name was Ryokan in the 18th century. "Oh, that my monk's robes were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world." And that inspiration really comes from being in community with you all today in the small groups and listening to a beautiful expression of love and care and investigation and a sense of service in the world. It's beautiful. "Oh, that my monk's robes were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world." So there we hear compassion, don't we? That compassionate heart wanting to gather up all the suffering. And we hear wisdom, too. We hear the wisdom, the equanimity of knowing that I can't. No, I can't necessarily stop the suffering in this world. We know this. We know this. It doesn't mean we don't apply ourselves in service to others or to our own heart, to both. But equanimity really is the grounding place for that dilemma, if you will, that Ryokan expresses in that line in his poem. This may be familiar to some of you also. This is from Senxiang, a third Zen patriarch, verses on the faith mind. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Ooh. Does make sense, though, doesn't it? It does make sense. So what I feel invited to in that teaching is to notice sometimes the suffering in preferences and not to necessarily negate them or even, you know, assume that they'll disappear. You know, it's often said that beings who are fully enlightened will have preferences, but not be attached to them. So it's just an interesting reflection. But we can also get a taste of this, you know, in small ways when we're on retreat. You know, when we can let go of something, when there's something that we can feel ourselves like clinging to or holding on to, whether it's a particular thought in the mind or focus of the mind or just even, you know, having a whole sitting where you're just in a state of aversion or wanting, and then it, you know, it disappears. It's like, did you do something to make it disappear? Maybe you tried. How did that work? You know? Not so well often. Can you hear me okay, Marie? Okay, good. So, those are really inklings into the power of equanimity when the bubble pops or when we can actually start to be more present with discomfort. So one of the ways I feel invited into this teaching is, can I be equanimous with not being equanimous? Seriously, it's a really powerful practice. It's like when we're not in the state that we want to be in, whatever that is, can we recognize that as this human condition? My mind is caught right now. My heart is closed right now. And then, you know, even the my, it's like, try even this heart is. Does that feel a little different? Does that loosen up the grip of this is some personal failure that I need to fix or hide? These are the conditions of being human. So it was asked today about the feeling tone of neutral and how is that related to equanimity. And I did say that, you know, neutral itself in that category of feeling tone is just noticing neither pleasant or unpleasant. But equanimity is also described as the neutrality of mind or the evenness of mind. And the manifestations of that have the elements of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion in them. They're imbued, really. Equanimity is imbued with compassion and kindness and joy, too. And all these other Brahma Viharas, the loving kindness and compassion and empathetic joy, have equanimity within them. Or else they wouldn't be considered boundless. You know, we'd be caught in the sense of, you know, may you be happy. You know, may you stop doing this, fill in the blank, harmful behavior. Having the wish of that for another being or for ourselves that we love, who's harming oneself or another, yeah, of course we have that wish. Of course. You know, and many of us might be very familiar with that in terms of family members or ourselves, where we've worked with issues of addiction or loss or abuse, all kinds of things in our human condition that are harmful, unskillful, that are in our world. They're in our personal worlds, possibly. They're certainly in our collective global world. So the wanting of that, yeah. But the recognition that even with really pure intention, you know, wanting another's, wishing for another's well-being, doesn't necessarily make it so, does it? So you can say, well, why do we practice these? Well, because we're practicing the purification of our own hearts. The heart that doesn't discriminate. Oh, I can send loving kindness to you, but not you. You know, it purifies the heart. So we can even offer kindness and well wishes, possibly, to someone we don't agree with at all, or to someone whose ethics we find repulsive. That way, but in the categories, and you know, passed on the Buddha, there is a category of working with the difficult person, and it's for that very reason, to really, really cut through the one, not another, the preference aspect. So equanimity is its own natural flowering of mindfulness, of attendance, of concentration. So the more that you apply yourself, even if it's sort of like slogging along, but let me pay attention, what's happening right now? You know, developing concentration and mindfulness. Eventually what happens with that is the mind just starts to see clearly. It's just like the fog starts to disappear. You know, and if you're in a fog state right now, like don't even worry about it. Because it's not you, it's not permanent, it's conditional. But you may be connecting with a few moments as you listen to me. Yeah, I did have that experience. I did have that experience when suddenly it was just clear in my mind. Oh, this is clinging. Oh, and this clinging is causing suffering right now. You know, even if the clinging is like, do I go get a second cookie or not? You know, it's like, it could be in some ways so mundane, and also when we really tune into it, you can really feel the pain of the holding on. You know, I would find often at the end of retreats, I just would want to stay. And so there'd be a lot of suffering about wanting to stay on retreat. Some of you talked about this as a short retreat, you know, just that kind of greed type, I guess, you know, just loving that, what, you know, the fruits that were showing up, that I just would associate it with being on retreat. And in some ways, that's a fair association, just because we're in a pretty focused environment of almost like you could call it a laboratory, but certainly the conditions are so ripe for seeing clearly. You know, we're not distracted, we're not on the news, we're not on our phones, you're not responding to all the responsibilities in our lives. Most of us, I mean, some you may have, there may be some realities of, you know, if you have to check in with an ill family member, but for the most part, we're sequestering that. And we just have this opportunity to really dive in and see clearly. So as we really cultivate that mindfulness and attentiveness coming back again and again and again, the concentration gets stronger and the mind just sees clearly, it sees more clearly. And so what does it see? Well, it sees that things are changing, doesn't it? I mean, who doesn't know that things change? It's a very, you know, ask anybody on the street, do you agree that things change? So yeah, of course, things always change. That's how life is. And when you're directly practicing, it's not a concept. It's not a concept. It's a direct experience. And it can be kind of unsettling, can it? Have you noticed that? It's like, you know, because what happens with change, this is what the Buddha talked about these three characteristics that he understood from direct practicing, from practicing mindfulness and concentration and persevering was, oh, things change. And oh, that then impacts a sense of unsatisfactoriness, insecurity. Why? Well, because we can't hold on to the things that we want to hold on to, the things that feel good. You know, even beautiful insights, openings, heart openings, deep insights on retreat. We want to hold on to them. We want to preserve them. And then, you know, the next sitting's like, what happened? What happened? I was working so hard. Oh, the only thing that's happening is I'm just in this moment not seeing impermanence. That's all that's happening. And then maybe some clinging, some wanting. So we can bring that into our awareness. We see the wanting. Maybe we can even feel the sadness of whatever is passing. But you know, if it's arisen and you experienced it, it passes, probably going to come again. So that's one thing to reassure yourself about practice, that it is like planting seeds. They bear fruit, and you just don't necessarily know when that fruit is going to show up, right? But it does. And sometimes it just shows up not when you're trying to poke at it. It just surprises you. I'm trying to decide whether I want to tell you this story or not. I think I will. I don't know. I always like to hear stories. Do you want to hear a story? Personal story? Okay, what are you going to say? No. I told this story in the last Dharma talk I gave a few weeks ago. But it was poignant for me because it was uplifting in seeing the fruits of Dharma practice. That's why I'm sharing this story. So as you all know by now, I have a dog. Her name is Maddie. She's a great teacher because she's so in her instinctual nature. And part of her instinct and her breed, even though they told us, no, this dog isn't a hound. She's a hound. Hounds like to hunt. They like to run. She needs a lot of exercise. And the good news is it gets me out, gets me into the woods. So I have this place of walking her that not a lot of other people walk or dogs. And someone in my town owns the property. And so we have this deal, Maddie and I, that she gets to run free. She gets to have her exercise. She needs it. And she has a little assistance. She has a little vibrational collar that, you know, if she, you know, maybe gets too far, she gets a little buzz that just reminds her to come back. So she's so great about, in my mind anyway, about coming back that, you know, that doesn't get used that much. So in my mind, we're walking along, we're in the woods. There's kind of a highway up over here, but mostly it's a lot of woods, a lot of space. There's a river. she's doing her thing. I love watching her because she's an athlete. I'm enjoying the woods. This is actually the day of the eclipse, and there was snow. In New England, we had snow. Probably you did up here, too. We had snow a few days before. And the next thing I know, so Maddie's gone, and I'm assuming she's doing her thing. She's hunting. She's running. She'll come back. And I hear this crunch, crunch in the snow. And this older gentleman, probably like my age, so seemed older to me. Anyway, comes down the hill. You know, he's got these big galoshes on, and he does not look very happy. No, he doesn't look very happy. And I happen to have this little red leash in my hand. He's like, yeah, you should be using the leash. I'm like, what? And then he was really mad. He was angry. And he started to, well, because he heard me calling for the dog. So my dog was nowhere in sight, by the way. We're having this conversation. I don't know where she is. But I'm assuming she's going to come back. She usually does. So he's like, you should have your dog on a leash. And I could immediately feel like, excuse me, you know, I'm in the woods. This is, you know, I have permission to be here. I didn't say any of this. This is what's going on inside. I have permission to be here. My dog needs the exercise. You know, bugger off, you know. I can't believe this is going to be on tape. But anyway, and I saw in his face he was really, you know, he was just like lecturing me, you know, you should have your dog on a leash. But something happened. I could feel the defensiveness. I started to say the person's name who owns the land. So-and-so lets me walk here. It was so clear. He's just like, they looked like that wasn't landing anywhere for him. It wasn't going to cool his aversion, the aversion he was experiencing. So something just shifted in me, and this is the fruit of Dharma practice. It was like, you don't have to defend anything. There's nothing to defend here. This is another being who's upset. There's probably a reason why he's upset. You know, and so I just could feel the shift. I mean, I was really ready to explain, like, you know, why I was there, how important it is, the whole thing. I was ready to, like, convince him, you know, that I had a right to be there too. And I just looked at him, and he said, you know, my cat, my 15-year-old cat's afraid of her, afraid of the dog. He didn't know the gender of the dog. He was afraid of the dog. The dog's eating the cat food. And I'm thinking, oh, no. This is, I guess he has an outdoor cat. And then so I said, well, what kind of dog is it? I kind of knew it was Maddie. But, you know, she's Brindle. It's like, oh, okay. So I just said, well, what's your name? What's your name? Because somehow it was just like I was him. Like if it was my cat, some dog ate my cat's cat food. I mean, I know this is common sense, but there was, you know, it just, there was a sense of love and spaciousness and connection. There was confidence and faith that we were going to connect and heal. And it really came from just not needing to defend my position and knowing, you know, I will be figuring out a way to still walk my dog in the way that the dog needs. So just, what's your name? You know, I could feel him soften a little. He says his name. I said, oh, I'm Jean. You know, I said, I'm really sorry. And I meant it. You know, I really did. I know, and I could have explained, well, she's like this, she's like that, but it's like, I don't think it's what he could hear then. And then he said something, he's like, yeah, you know, and there is like a highway a little further out, and he's like, yeah, and she's crossing the highway. You know, and he's saying it in this gruff way, and I'm thinking, oh, he cares too. He cares about my dog, you know? So what happens if, you know, it's a little story, but I knew, you know, just in that space, it just gave me so much joy. That, wow, this is a fruit of practice. This is a fruit of Dharma practice, that the self didn't need explaining or defending. And it also didn't disappear. So I don't know if that's equanimity or that's a blend of just not having to defend, you know, because I am him. So many things don't go our way. You know, I recognize it's a nice story. You know, it certainly was personally inspiring to me about my own practice. But there's so many things in this world that are really seriously out of whack, wouldn't you say? Mm-hmm. Like seriously and painfully. And some of us, you know, in this room are, you know, we could call them the front lines of that in terms of doing activism work around the injustices in the world. Many of you are practitioners in the medical or mental health field in this room. That's its own kind of front lines. You know, how do we survive in that? How do we meet that? You know, because we want to be of service. We want to show up. And sometimes it's just very withering. So one of the gifts of equanimity, really, is, and one way we can cultivate it, is to notice where the attachment is. Where is the attachment to our actions? It's not acting, okay? And if that is really a misunderstanding of equanimity, is this, if it's some kind of like, yeah, everything is all okay, you know? No. Well, that's not an expression of equanimity. Expression of equanimity is understanding things as they are, understanding the conditions, and relating from there. So we can have strong motivation to right a wrong, if you will, or address something in our lives or in our families' lives. Any of you have worked with addiction and family members, you can have powerful motivation out of wanting to end suffering by trying to help your loved one, you know, with that addiction. So we recognize the motivation, we recognize the intention, and we also let go of the result. That's wisdom. That's not passivity. It's understanding we can bring our fullness to a situation, recognizing we really don't have any control over the results. And that's an expression of equanimity. And that is imbued with wisdom and love. Actually, I'm going to read you a quote. Some of you may, I don't know if you've ever heard of Sweet Honey in the Rock. Is anyone familiar with Sweet Honey in the Rock? They're an African-American group of women, well, for many generations now. There's been many generations of them singing. What's the word for when you sing without accompaniment? Why am I forgetting the word? Thank you. Acapella. Acapella group. And the leader, the leader who started that is Bernice Johnson Reagan. She's also activist in the civil rights movement. And she's talking about her actions back then, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And she says, now I sit back and look at some of the things we did, and I say, what in the world came over us? But death had nothing to do with what we were doing. If somebody shot us, we would be dead. And when people died, we cried and went to funerals. And we went and did the next thing the next day because it was really beyond life and death. It was really like sometimes you know what you're supposed to be doing. And when you know what you're supposed to be doing, it's somebody else's job to kill you. You know, it also makes me think of the great minister, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And he always said that, you know, he was a minister first before his political activism. And the time he was leading the group of people to go over the bridge in Selma, there were, you know, he stood there and there was all these armed officers with guns, and he stood there. He just paused and he turned around and said to his people, "We're turning around." That is not defeat, hardly. You know, he clearly reflected on what was most likely going to be the outcome of that, and he wasn't willing. And I'm not trying to say this is how every activist needs to behave. I'm just giving an example of the power of equanimity, the power of reflection, the power of love in that. He turned around. He asked everyone to turn around. I said that in a group years ago. It was a Dharma setting, and someone said, "Well, that was very, you know, a conscious political choice on his part." And she said it just like that. It's like, well, maybe it was. But I really relate to him saying, you know, "I'm a minister first." He didn't want those lives to be lost. So, you know, their equanimity can come in times of, you know, great challenges, life-threatening challenges, and little ones, you know, when you're walking your dog. It all adds up. How to strengthen equanimity? Well, we can just be mindful of attachment to outcomes. So again, it's not repressing preference in the sense of, yeah, I want this outcome. Are you kidding me? I know what I want here. And, you know, behind that might be because I want peace, because I want, you know, all the ethics, non-harm, skillfulness, wise speech, care in this community, in this world community. But if we're not aware that we really don't have control of outcomes, we suffer a lot. And we can veer into a kind of like righteousness that in its own way can be toxic. And you know, that obviously bears a personal reflection, you know, because there's certainly many reasons to feel angry, rageful even, at rage. It's interesting, isn't it? It's like, it's almost like it's, you know, one of the things I learned as a psychotherapist, that anxiety is contagious and depression is contagious. Meaning like if you're around the energy of anxiety, no judgment here at all, feel it yourself. You know, if you're around the energy of depression, you can sometimes be impacted by it yourself. So when we're around this kind of really proliferation of greed, hatred, and delusion, it's not that difficult to feel some of the same in response, even though our wished outcomes are for the opposite. And equanimity is that bridge. So hopefully you can hear. It's not passive. It's recognizing the truth of life. The 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. The truth of life, understanding what's often referred to in Buddhism as the worldly winds or the vicissitudes of life. That in this worldly life exists pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, loss and gain, praise and blame. It's just part of being alive. Those are unavoidable aspects of life. It certainly doesn't mean or suggest that we live in an equitable culture where some people aren't more privileged than others. That's true. It's true in our culture. Another way to work with equanimity, to strengthen equanimity in ourselves, is the way it's framed in some of the teachings, is association with the wise, and avoiding, if one can, associating with those who regularly behave unskillfully. That could fall into a privilege category. We certainly can't always avoid people that behave unskillfully. It's the pithy frame is associate with the wise and avoid the unwise. But that isn't always the case in our world. At the same time, we can take that encouragement to listen to Dharma talks or go to Sangha sittings or just to cultivate Sangha friendships. Or friendships of others who share some of the same values. So in some ways you have a place of rejuvenation, a place to restore. Mm-hmm. But it also makes me think about when someone, I remember hearing about this very early on in 12, being familiar with the 12-step program, where friends would say, I've really been encouraged by my sponsor to not hang out with people who drink right now. And it just made a lot of sense. It's not like that you're judging your friends. It's just like, it's easy to get pulled in that. So I often use that analogy that we know what it's like to be in the company of another who maybe doesn't like gossiping. So let's just say you're in a conversation with another, it's easy to fall into gossip, for sure. But sometimes when another just says, and not in a righteous way, but I don't really feel comfortable with this. It's kind of like, oh, okay. It can be really a gift. It's like we can raise each other up in that way based on our values and our commitment to non-harm. So that's how I understand associating with the wise. It's really refueling in the values and the commitment of non-harm and our practice. So it gives more fuel to engage wisely and caringly when we're in conflict, with it, which is inevitable, whether it's personal or global. The other encouragement, and this has come up here and you've heard me talk about pleasure. I do think it's important not to bypass recognizing pleasure, because it's easy to do that. However, also being mindful to not be seduced by pleasure. So the wise one knows that it comes, feel it, enjoy it, and recognize its impermanent nature. That's an expression of equanimity. It's like the William Blake poem, "She who binds herself to joy doth the winged life destroy. She who kisses it as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise." I'll say it again. They who bind themselves to joy, doth the winged life destroy. They who kiss it as it flies live in eternity's sunrise. The Buddha said there's no higher happiness than peace. So can we be peaceful with how things are? In a very alive, active, receptive, responsive way. I think one of the doorways I have found in this is recognizing vulnerability, is recognizing the truth of vulnerability and being human. This is from David White, the Irish poet, says, "Vulnerability is not a weakness, a passing indisposition, or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, and abiding undercurrent of our natural state. To run from vulnerability is to run from the essence of our nature. The attempt to be invulnerable is the vain attempt to become something we are not, and most especially, to close off our understanding of the grief of others. More seriously, in refusing our vulnerability, we refuse the help needed at every turn of our existence and immobilize the essential tidal and conversational foundations of our identity." He later says, "The only choice we have as we mature is how we inhabit our vulnerability, how we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance." How we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance. Our choice is to inhabit vulnerability as generous citizens of loss, robustly and fully, or conversely, as misers and complainers, reluctant and fearful, always at the gates of existence, but never bravely and completely attempting to enter, never wanting to risk ourselves, never walking fully through the door. It's courageous to open to vulnerability. It's delusional not to, isn't it? So you can see that this equanimity, it has a coolness to it, but it's imbued with understanding vulnerability. It's imbued with compassion. It's imbued with loving kindness. It's imbued with delight in another's joy. Why? Because we're not threatened by another's joy. We can celebrate it. You know, and it's unhooking from the conditioned world, the conditioned mind, the conditioned culture that says we need to compete, that we're separate, we're individual, we're separate. There's only so much at the table. It's It's just the complete, insane denial of the truth of being alive. And it has horrific outcomes. And things are as they are. Another way to cultivate equanimity is to cultivate it as one of the Brahmaviharas, so with phrases. One of the phrases is things are as they are. Things are as they are. Another one, and this can be a little sticky, it's the English interpretation, is all beings are the owners of their own actions. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions and not upon my wishes for them. So when we think about, gross victimization, it's hard to say someone is an owner of their action. I wouldn't say so. But how we relate to circumstances, we can find meaning in that phrase, I think. Some Tibetan monks who were tortured, they were imprisoned by the Chinese when the Chinese took over Tibet, and saw their loved ones murdered and they were tortured. They were asked about how much they must have, hated the torturers. And they were horrified by that. It's like, hate them? Like, no, that's another realm of hell. We have compassion for that level of delusion, that level of suffering. Whew. I mean, that's a pretty advanced practice, isn't it? That's a pretty advanced expression of understanding life and equanimity. Anything else I wanted to add here? The other way to really strengthen equanimity, guess what I'm going to say? Keep practicing. Wise attention, continuing mindfulness. It will flower from that. I was once sitting a number of years ago, sitting in a retreat with Sharon Salzberg, and she must have some talk she had just given, and we were meeting as a small group afterwards. And my heart was just breaking with just opening to like the suffering in the world. It was just like, I felt like, figuratively, I crawled into that meeting room, like I was on my hands and knees. I didn't physically do it, but that's how I felt in my being. And I sat there when it was my turn to talk. It was just like, how do we stay open to this? How do we do this? And there's so much pain. And she just looked at me and she said, there's also joy in the world. And what happened in that moment was simply this. I knew the truth of what she said. There was no argument. She wasn't saying, oh, you're too focused on suffering, or just pay attention to the good things. She wasn't saying that. She was expressing equanimity. That was probably 30 or 40 years ago. I just won't ever forget it. So I'd like to close with another quote. From Jane Hirschfield. Some of you may know her. She's a poet and a Buddhist practitioner. I have been given this existence, these years on this earth, to accept what has come into my lifetime. Wars, loves, trucks, betrayals, kindness. I must take them. I must find a way to live in this world. You can't refuse it. And along with the difficult is the radiant, the beautiful, the intimacy with which each one of us enters the life of all of us and figures out what is our conversation. What is my responsibility? What must be suffered? What can be changed? How can I meet this in a way which both lets me open my eyes the next day and also perhaps, if I'm lucky, can be of service? How can I meet this in a way which both lets me open my eyes the next day and also perhaps, if I'm lucky, can be of service? And I hope when you hear can be of service, you fully understand that as a new parent, as a grandparent, as a friend, as a teacher, as a lover, as a person who professionally cares for others, as a farmer, as a poet, as a preacher. We all have a seat at the table. Let's sit together.